Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Manual Therapy Forum podcast. Today we get to hear from our friend Mike Baum again. Mike is actually joining me for this podcast during a weekend seminar that he's teaching for PNF2 through the Institute of Physical Art. And for a number of you, if you're familiar with PNF or you're a practitioner of it or you've had training with it, I think you're really going to like this podcast a lot. Mike already went through in our previous podcast a bunch of details that he's done with PNF, his own thoughts, and kind of how he utilizes it. And we get some more info from him about those things for this podcast as well. Just different topics, I think, than what we covered before. So if you're a fan of Mike, you're definitely going to want to listen to this one. As before, I certainly enjoyed my time with him. He's a great speaker. If you've never had a course from him before, I highly recommend it. One of the things that's nice about PNF too is you're learning not just the same concepts that you learned previously in what IPA teaches as PNF1, but you're applying that to real live patients in the class. So it's basically a 3.5-day class, and for 3 of those days, you're actually treating patients, utilizing what you learn in the class. So it's pretty amazing. The thing about it is, with those patients, though, is they are patients with neurological impairments. So you could maybe get away with it being a little sloppy on what we might consider an orthopedic patient. But when you have to actually treat a neurologically impaired patient, you have to, you know, be one in the pattern. You have to be in the groove. You have to have your contacts right and your different cueing correct, or the technique's not going to work. So if you can do it correctly in that setting with those type of patients, then you know you got a halfway decent grasp of what they're trying to teach you. So having said that, like I said before, I highly recommend it. It's a great course. Mike is a great instructor. One of the nice things that I like about him as an instructor is he really gives tons of examples. I mean, constant examples. He's such a well-seasoned clinician, seeing so many different types of patients, and really truly uses what he teaches, you know, practices what he preaches. And with that, he has a huge background of patient examples that he can draw from. It doesn't matter what kind of therapist you are or what setting you practice in, he can relate what he's trying to teach with any type of example you need to actually get it. So that's a nice thing about him in terms of being an instructor. And something, honestly, I hope I can aspire to be something like that at some point, you know, for the different courses that I get to teach. So anyway, having said all those things, I really hope you enjoyed this podcast with Mike again. If you have any different feedback, please provide it. You know, as always before, check us out on our different social media accounts. Leave a comment. Share it with friends. Yeah, you pretty much get the point by now. So having said all that, enjoy this podcast with Mike. All right, well, we're getting to sit here with Mike Baum again. Mike, hey, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So for all of you listening, we are getting to hang out with Mike Baum again because he is in Chico, California, getting to teach PNF2, and I'm taking the course. There's no way I would pass up the chance to take a course from Mike, and I'd recommend the same for everybody out there if you get a chance. But Mike, while we're talking about it, do you mind taking this microphone and telling us what PNF2 is? Like, what are you teaching us this weekend?
Okay, so PNF2 is the advanced PNF class that's sponsored through the Institute of Physical Art. And what we do is we cover all the basic principles and all the material from the first PNF1 class. Then we learn extremity patterns, upper extremity, lower extremity, all 4 diagonals, and all 4 diagonal patterns. And then we treat patients. The patients we treat are all neurologically involved, and some are multiple trauma, some are spinal cord, some are stroke, some are head injury, and we take the patterns that we learn and we apply them to our neurologically involved patients. If you make changes, you'll know it right away. If you're doing the pattern incorrectly, you'll also know that right away. By learning the patterns on neurologically involved patients and understanding the interrelationship of the diagonals, when you go back to the orthopedic clinic, you're better able to use it in that setting, combining the PNF patterns with both soft tissue and joint mobilization, and you get more efficient results, better results.
So one of the things that I think is pretty interesting, and there, I mean, I'm sure that there's some people out there who haven't been exposed to PNF, obviously the way you have, or even the way, you know, myself have, or other colleagues that we have, is just kind of the impact that it has, not just for what they may have been taught in school for the neurologically involved patient, but from my time with you, speaking with you, getting to hang around with you or take a class from you, it becomes pretty evident very quickly how much you use this on pretty much everybody. And doesn't matter what they come in the door with, whether it's neurologic or orthopedic or anything else for that matter, you basically use it for almost everybody. And one thing I was hoping, you know, you did speak about this a lot with our previous conversation that we had, which again, I think is great. I was hoping you could kind of speak a little bit about that again, because when we take a class from you, it's nonstop examples. And I don't know if you're, well, I know most of them are come from patients that you've treated. And from that, you can also kind of, you know, riff and make up a patient case because you've seen all these different patients before and give us examples, you know, time and time again, just constant examples. And that's one of the things that I really like, because for somebody who's less experienced and they haven't had a chance to use this these things before, these techniques or interventions, they may not know quite how to apply it in the clinic when they're not as experienced, or they haven't seen that many different types of patients. And for someone who is more experienced, it's kind of nice to again see that, oh, well, these aren't just for X type of patients. You can really use these for almost anything or anybody.
Well, I would agree. And, you know, all the patient examples are patients that I've treated over the last 33 years. I started doing PNF, really getting skillful at it, or learning and getting more skillful at it, when I started the Vallejo program in April of 1990. So that's already been 29 years. Yeah, 29 years. So I do use PNF on all patients who walk through the door. I have a private practice in Junction City, Oregon. It's in a rural community, a wonderful area to work. We get people with all sorts of multiple trauma. We have geriatrics, we get pediatrics, we get people coming in from Eugene. I get some people coming in from the coast, some people coming in from the Salem-Portland area. And so it keeps things interesting, because it's not just one patient population, it varies. And with PNF, you can use this with any patient diagnosis, because you're looking at what the dysfunction is versus what the actual physical diagnosis is. You're looking at what they can do that's strong to help what they can do that's dysfunctional. Are they stiff? What can you use that's strong to help mobilize what's stiff? What can you use that's strong to help get better motor control and neuromuscular education on what they don't have good motor control for? Common examples are, you can use the upper extremity patterns in a contralateral lifting technique to increase VMO facilitation of a total knee or an ACL. You can use the contralateral lower extremity flexion abduction pattern to do the same. You can use lower extremities in a hook lying position with stabilizing reversals to facilitate short neck flexion for somebody who just had a C5-6 intercervical discectomy fusion. You can use cervical techniques to work with somebody who has a weak trunk, inability to stabilize lumbar spine when they're doing bed mobility or rolling. So with PNF, it's a philosophy of treatment where you use what the patient has that's positive to help what they have that's dysfunctional. We spend years and years trying to figure out, okay, where are the dysfunctions? What are we looking at? Where are the instabilities? Where are the fixated instabilities, hypomobilities? Where are the torsions? Where are the ligamentous laxities? But sometimes you have a paradigm that may not fit that patient. With PNF, the paradigm fits every patient, because you don't do it instead of what you normally do. You do it in addition to what you normally do. If you do soft tissue mobilization, muscle energy technique, high velocity, low amplitude thrust, functional mobilization, whatever you do, you can use PNF to help get that to the next level, both for localization and isolation of where the dysfunction is and neuromuscular education and motor control.
So a couple of things come to mind that I need to make sure that I hit based on what you talked about. But one of the things that immediately comes to mind is the difference between what I would say a majority of people are taught in graduate school about what PNF is, and a lot of it could be, you know, just the different diagonals for the extremities. And, you know, maybe you get into some other stuff related to a developmental sequence going through the different positions. But can you, I don't want to say dispel myths, but can you talk a little bit about the typical things that people may learn about the diagonals, you know, if we just keep it at that, and how what a lot of people are taught, you know, very wide diagonal or other things that are pretty much incorrect, and kind of what the real diagonals are and how you would know if you're actually in the correct pattern.
Sure. So let's talk about PNF in a nutshell. I was honored and blessed to have the experience of working with Dr. Herman Cabot back in 1993 when he came to Kaiser Permanente Rehabilitation Center in Vallejo. Thank you. And he was a keynote speaker at the first International PNF Association conference, and he ended up staying for another 6 months. And so, again, we who were on staff were fortunate enough to work with him. And we asked him, how do you develop all this stuff? And, you know, again, he went to a conference Sister Kenny was giving, and she was one of the first physical therapists to ever work with polio patients and get good results. And he started developing PNF because he had asked her some questions, and this is what he had told us. He said, why are you doing everything in linear planes when things have spiral and diagonal components to them? And so he started developing PNF based on that. And he looked at the basic principles. He looked at a lot of principles from Sherrington, reciprocal inhibition, successive induction, temporal spatial summation. But he also looked at how people moved efficiently, and he came up with the diagonal patterns. Now, in PNF, the diagonal patterns are extremely specific. They're narrow diagonals, and three things happen when you're in the diagonal pattern. The patient is inherently stronger, they get better utilization of the quick stretch reflex, and they get better purposeful spreading response from strong to weak, which we describe or call irradiation. So irradiation is an associated reaction that's purposeful, specific, and goes from source or strong to target, which is the more dysfunctional component. You're not trying to facilitate a primitive movement pattern. You're not trying to facilitate a pathological synergy. What you're trying to do is help improve function, direct and indirect, having strong facilitate weak. And when you're in the PNF pattern, it's a much more efficient way to do that than if you're not in the pattern. If you're in the tight diagonal pattern, it's much easier to facilitate rotator cuff. It's much easier to facilitate deep rotators of the hip. It's much easier to facilitate core stabilization of the lumbar spine, pelvic floor, multifidus, transversus abdominis. It's easier to facilitate short neck flexors. And so it makes my job much easier.
Yeah. And that's something that, you know, we've definitely noticed over the weekend. And can you mention what you told us this weekend about how much do you resist, like what you call the appropriate resistance? What do you say about that?
Sure. Well, one of the problems is when I learned PNF in school, and I went to a great school, Northeastern University, but when we learned the PNF section, the resistance was called maximal resistance, but we didn't understand what that meant. We didn't understand, is that how much the therapist could push on the patient or the patient could push on the therapist? So we use the term appropriate resistance, and the definition would be that amount of resistance which allows a smooth, coordinated movement to occur through the desired range of motion. Because you may want to do an isometric hold so the person is stable in the new position you put them in. You may use a technique called stabilizing reversals. We used to call it or refer to it as rhythmic stabilization. Or you may want to get a smooth coordinated movement through greater range or an isotonic reversal. And so in order to get a smooth coordinated movement, you have to traction or approximate. You have to use either joint compression or joint distraction combined with resistance to allow that motion to occur. If you over-resist, you're going to see aberrant movement patterns. If you don't resist enough, you're just going to be doing it passively. So by definition, you're going to have to change the resistance throughout the movement pattern to allow, again, a smooth, coordinated movement to occur.
So I'm putting you on the spot a little bit right now, but for the patients that we have had in the course this weekend, are there any particular things that stand out, you know, as examples to anybody who would listen, from what you've seen as an instructor and for these particular patients that have come in and the things that we've been able to do with them?
Sure. Well, we've had an interesting patients who've come in for this class. We had a couple of people who had brainstem infarcts. One had a dissected carotid artery after a motor vehicle accident. And then through the clot afterward, it was vertebrobasilar artery. And we had one who had multiple trauma. He was in a motor vehicle accident and sustained a head injury. And that was 4 years ago. We've had quite a few stroke patients coming in. And what we've really noticed is we've made good changes on all these patients. Some of these patients have actually had their injury or sustained their injury greater than 4 years ago. Some were up to 14 months ago. Everybody's made great changes. And what we've really done is utilized what they do well to facilitate what's dysfunctional. Examples of this are one of our quadriplegic patients who actually injured himself in 1983. He's an incomplete quad, and he was having some shoulder pain. And we did something that myself and my supervisor Sharon Nicholas and two other people at Vallejo, Christina Stockberle and Russell Lee, helped me with. We called it the PNF quadriplegic shoulder protocol. We were able to help diminish his shoulder pain by teaching him how to center his humeral head, utilizing the glenoid over the humerus, and then facilitating rotator cuff contraction. And so that seemed to work pretty well. We were able to work with some of our other patients, helping with their ambulation skills, helping with their sit-to-stand, helping with their balance, by using PNF basic principles, including tractioning through the head and neck, utilizing approximation through trunk. We had one young man who had the head injury where we were able to increase his arousal by doing a technique Dr. Cabot taught us and putting him on a BOSU and doing sustained oscillatory movements to increase his ability, his arousal through limbic system. And that seemed to work. And we followed that up with cervical traction. We followed that up with stabilizing reversals through trunk. Then we got him moving, got him on the ground, got him rolling, got him into a modified quadruped, up into kneeling. And then he ambulated and he showed increased step length and increased base of support, which actually looked pretty good.
One of the things that I was thinking about earlier that I did want to bring up, kind of switching topics a little bit, was I've said this before, but the longer I practice, the more I'm realizing that there's much more involvement of the neuromuscular system with things that we might consider hypomobile or restricted or anything like that than I personally originally have once thought. Not that I was taught that, but it's just kind of the way my small mind worked at one point. And, you know, the more I practice, the more things I learn, and the more I try and refine what I do, I'm, you know, realizing again and again that anything that might appear hypomobile or restricted for whatever reason is becoming more and more of just more of a neuromuscular thing, guarding response, reflexive guarding strategies, other things like that, instead of a true stuck joint or stiff joint or whatever. Especially when you get into the extremities, if it's more of the vertebrae, you know, it could be other things depending on the type of person you're treating. But that's one thing I've really grown to appreciate and grown to. I guess I would say use more our neuromuscular treatments or PNF things because, you know, not just getting to practice it, but getting to teach some of it a little bit with IPA, just realizing more and more that there's more to this than just what we might have thought before of just something stiff and going and move it. And that's one thing I really appreciate hearing you speak about is how much you incorporate that with all of your patients in the class today, you were talking and you were showing how to do a very gentle mobilization at the glenohumeral joint in pattern, in more of a shortened position of a pattern, but utilizing resistance within a pattern to help mobilize the glenohumeral joint. And I mean, the mobilization was pretty much, you know, with the humeral head centered within the glenoid, but not moving through an extreme of range at all. And you're really just getting it to become more seated within the glenoid fossa. Do you mind sharing your thoughts about that? I mean, do you find similar things, or have you thought about that much in the past? I mean, what do you think about the stuff that I was just mentioning?
Well, I would agree with you that the more I learn, the more I know I don't know. And it's very interesting because things I once took for granted as specific joint dysfunctions, I'm looking at more at irritation of peripheral nerves, which I may have not thought about. You know, examples of this are not only some of the tenderness around the shoulder, maybe not being only subacromial bursa, but maybe irritation of superficial areas of the axillary nerve, irritations of the knee that I used to think, oh, this must be a peasant's ring bursitis, or this must be a small medial meniscal tear, or this must be a plica syndrome. It might be a saphenous nerve irritation. And I've been looking at that more and more as I've been having more and more patients who don't fit the typical patient presentation, and we start mobilizing soft tissue above and below the joint area, utilizing PNF and soft tissue, and they start making dramatic, remarkable changes that don't really coincide with a meniscal tear, or don't really coincide with only a partial rotator cuff tear, or don't only coincide with a hypomobile segment of the cervical spine. Maybe there's an elevated first rib, but maybe the first rib is elevated because there is a partial tear of the rotator cuff, and the person has increased trigger points of levator scapula, and there's an instability at C4-5, C5-6, and now the levator's tight, scalenes are tight, first rib is elevated, we mobilize everything, but the driving force is really a shoulder dysfunction. We work on the glenohumeral joint, work on the shoulder, less stress through the shoulder girdle, cervical spine is better, all the cervical symptoms seem to dissipate. And I've had some very interesting patients over the past few years who really fit that paradigm, where there absolutely was cervical dysfunction, there was trauma on MRI where there was cervical disc degeneration, there was pain in the upper extremity, however, it wasn't radicular type pain. We weren't seeing the three things of radiculopathy with sensory loss through specific or pain through a specific dermatomal distribution, changes in DTRs, and fatigability with myotomal strength distributions. We're seeing generalized strength and weakness, and we started using PNF to help stabilize and center the humeral head, and we started seeing huge changes in cervical spine. And saved a couple of people some cervical fusions, which was nice. So, you know, again, the more I learn, the more I go, wow, that's not what I would have said 10 years ago. And I keep getting awed by how much more there is to learn and to know.
So we've also been talking about, you know, different things over the weekend, but you yourself and kind of your own journey from going from Kaiser Vallejo and treating those type of patients to working your way into a private practice. You mentioned trying to perfect and hone your skills for various different aspects of being a physical therapist. Are there any particular things that you've been trying to get better with lately?
Well, I try to get better with everything. But, you know, lately I've been trying to take more and more high-level manipulation courses, high-velocity, low-amplitude thrust. I've been very blessed that I've been able to take some wonderful courses with Dr. Lori Hartman and Gibbons and Tejon. And I'm a slow learner, so I tend to take the courses 2, 3, and 4 times if they're available. And each time I take it, it's better and better, and I learn more and more. There's always something more to learn. I tend to try to learn from everybody. And what I find, though, is I keep coming back to PNF in that I may think, and an example is, I may think that I have a hypomobile segment at maybe C4-5, C5-6, and then I'll mobilize first rib, mobilize scalenes, mobilize second rib, and do PNF shoulder girdle patterns. And then what I'll find is instead of having two hypomobile segments, I now have just one because the other has cleared itself. And then I'm able to do whatever manual therapy technique is appropriate for that patient, whether it be a functional mobilization, HVLAT, maybe an upslope, or muscle energy. It's all appropriate for what the patient's presentation is. And so again, the more I try to get better at my manual therapy skills, the more I keep combining PNF with it. Because once I've done the manual therapy technique, I still have to get the neuromuscular education and motor control. Examples are, I would have somebody come in with a lumbar dysfunction or SI joint dysfunction, and I would do my functional mobilization techniques and my manipulation on lumbosacral or sacroiliac joint. Now they have the mobility restored, but I now have to work on this stability. So now I'll work on PNF stabilized reversals and hook, lying, and bridging. Then I'll start working on specific unilateral patterns. I'll work on reciprocal scapular and pelvic patterns so they're more efficient with their gait. Then I'll give them a home exercise program of one to two exercises. Because again, just because the joint is now moving does not mean that they have no neuromuscular control there. You have to retrain the homunculus. You have to go into the higher centers through muscle spindles, through type 2 mechanoreceptors. You can do that through resistance. You can do that through joint approximation or traction blended with resistance. And that's really the beauty of PNF because it allows that to occur.
So with your all of your different things that you've learned and tried to refine, you know, with the, this example of higher skill level of manipulation, for example, is there been anything related to PNF or otherwise, you know, not even necessarily related to PNF, that you think has helped your skill acquisition for that particular type of intervention? Does that make sense? Yeah,
it does. It does. So what's helped me a lot with PNF, especially working with neurologically involved patients, is I tend to go in with a lot softer hands. So I tend to go in not as vigorous. I tend to go in a little bit softer. I tend to really assess end feel first and then base where I'm going to do technique based on what the actual end feel is. I tend to utilize neuromuscular well, let's just go back to PNF. I tend to use PNF to clear neuromuscular holding patterns. So once you clear a holding pattern, you get the person to actually relax, you can then assess joint mobility. If the person's guarding, sometimes it's very hard to assess what's truly hypomobility. And as my friend Kent Kaiser would say, your hypomobility may be a fixated instability. Your person who's doing a lot of guarding may be doing a lot of guarding because it's an unstable segment for a reason. Let's look at an example. Let's just go to the shoulder. Person has a positive apprehension sign. They're going to guard like heck. They have an instability. The person has an unstable segment at cervical spine. Maybe they have a lysthesis. Maybe a grade 2 lysthesis. They're going to guard like heck. Then when they finally do films, you may go, oh, no wonder they were guarding. They have a grade 2. They're C4-5, their C5 is anterior, there's an anterior lysthesis of 4 millimeters. So there's a reason that they're guarding. And so with PNF, you can assess what the end feel is. You can try to change their guarding pattern so that once they're actually relaxed, you can actually go in there and assess joint mechanics. So that's helped quite a bit. The other thing is it's told me when I shouldn't do any vigorous manual therapy, because when you go through your scan exams and you go through special testing, you may find out that once they have relaxed, there's a segment that's moving quite a bit too much. And that may be something that really needs to be stabilized more than mobilized. And it may need something more, maybe surgical intervention, maybe PRP. There's new things out that are going on now with regenerative medicine. And there's more people that we could send them to, as far as physicians, who may jump in and do something non-surgically that may help with improving form closure of the joint, improving stability from the passive inert structures. You know, I've been a very big fan lately of PRP and combining that with PNF. Stem cell combining with PNF, we've had great results. I had a young man who came in, football player. He had a full thickness tear, a root tear of a medial meniscus. He dislocated his patella 3 times. They did stem cell and PRP on his knee. We worked on him. At the 6-week mark, he went back to his physician. I said, when are you going to go back and play ball? Physician said, when the physical therapist determines it. We got him a brace. We had him do sports-related testing, single leg hop for distance, crossover hop, timed hop. Everything was 100%. Got him his brace. By the seventh week, he was back playing football. Surprised the heck out of me. So, you know, we're seeing improvement with more of the regenerative medicine techniques and utilizing PNF for the neuromuscular reeducation, motor control has been dramatic with working with those patients. So it's been interesting. It's been a fun new way to utilize PNF with some of these patients who are no longer post-surgery, but interventional medicine is really getting bigger in our area.
Cool. So change the topic. Change the topic here. One of the things I wish I could go back and ask, you know, different people that we've spoken with. I think I've asked a few people this, but I'm going to ask you. If you could go back and talk to yourself as a new grad, you know, coming out of PT school, or within the first 5 years of your professional practice, and give yourself advice or, you know, kind of change what you did back then or how you thought, like, you know, what might you tell yourself, you know, that early in your career?
I would tell myself, get a mentor. I was very, very fortunate in that we had very good people where I first worked at. When I was a cooperative education student, I had a very good person I worked with, Joel Rosenstein. And when I started working at Kessler Rehab, I had a lot of good people I was working with. When I was at Kaiser, though, I had people actually mentoring me. You know, you were in a 3-month program, and then we had advanced training after that, and we had people who were just phenomenal. Some from Sue Adler, absolutely phenomenal. I consider her a mentor. Liesl Harper was there, a great mentor. Hink Mangold, who had passed away a few years ago, wonderful mentor. These were people who had such high skill levels that when we had questions, we could come up to them. You know, some of the people who were still there, Tim Jostin, Chris Pappas, these people acted as mentors and not just instructors to me while I was at the program, but mentors. You had any questions, you couldn't ask them and grab them. So I was extremely fortunate in that when I was 4 to 5 years out of school, I was able to get myself in a position where I could be with people who were light years ahead of where I was and learn from them. So I would tell people the most important thing in the first 5 years is learn, because what you learn in school is to know enough information to hopefully not kill anybody. And that's not no joke on that. An example would be one of the patients we had today had been in a motor vehicle accident. He had airbag deployment in his face. He had had some vertigo. He went to the hospital. They couldn't figure it out. He went to a chiropractor. Well, I love chiropractors, I love therapists, but unfortunately it turned out that this poor person had had a dissected vertebral basilar artery, and after manipulation, he had had a stroke. And, you know, sometimes, unfortunately, his artery had already been dissected. So, you know, these are things that, you know, you want to know the rules. You want to know when not to do a technique on a person and really what to look for. And early in my career, I had treated a lot of post-traumatic patients, a lot of spinal cord patients, a lot of stroke patients, and you really see how bad things can be, especially if you see somebody who's in a locked-in syndrome, which is absolutely horrendous. And you always want to make sure that you're aware of what the contraindications are of any technique. And by having a good mentor, they will let you know over and over again when a technique is appropriate and when you should really hold off and wait and maybe get further consultation through a physician or further imaging. And so, you know, that's really what I would tell any new grad is really get someone who has advanced skills to help perfect your own.
So you did just mention a couple of things about, you know, what makes somebody a good mentor, but you yourself have served as a mentor to many people along the, you know, past years of your career. What are some other things that go through your mind in terms of what makes somebody a good mentor?
Well, I appreciate the kind words. First, thank you so much. You know, again, I'm always honored when anybody wants to interview me. I think what makes a good mentor is you have to listen. you have to really listen and you have to really be patient. And when you're working with someone who is trying to develop a different skill set than they have, and you have that expertise in that skill set, you need to look at what they do right, not just what they're having problems with, and then build on that. And you need to be able to reinforce what they're doing well and make changes on what they're having a problem with, but not to the point where they feel that they've lost all their confidence. You know, you don't want to break anybody's confidence. You know, having done physical therapy for 33 years, I know what I'm good at, I know what I'm really good at, and I know what I really need work in. And everybody has different skill sets. And my skill set, I'm good at PNF because I was mentored by some of the best people I think on earth in PNF. And there's quite a few people quite a bit better than me at PNF. In fact, I'm going to the IPNFA or International PNF Association conference next week to go listen to Mary Massary speak and see some of the people I haven't seen in 25 years. And there's some incredible people out there. So I know what my skill set is, but I also know what I'm not strong in. And so with physical therapy, as with any other profession, everybody has strengths and everybody has weaknesses. And it's very important as a mentor to know when you have to help somebody develop their skill set, but still give them positive reinforcement so that they don't feel as if they're incompetent. You don't want anybody feeling like they can't do it. Just because I have a better skill set, a specific technique, doesn't mean that the other person's still not making good changes. I'm just trying to make them more efficient at getting better changes, give them the ability to make functional changes maybe a little bit more efficiently and faster, given the limited time we have to work with patients. I'll give you quick examples. Quick examples are the amount of therapy time we get authorized by some insurance companies are 8 visits, and that's it. Some insurance companies, we get 30 visits per year, that's it. Some we get 8 visits, some we get 12 visits, some we get 6 visits, that's it. So unfortunately, sometimes based on payer source, unless you're a cash pay practice in the outpatient setting, you need to be efficient, really find out what the problem is and figure out a way to address it. And if you have a good mentor, that person will help you reach those conclusions a little bit faster.
Something else I was thinking about earlier when you were talking about different things was, first of all, you know, you've had pretty extensive background and not just PNF, but you've taken a lot of different coursework over your years where you're pretty eclectic, I would say, more so than many other people that I've really ever met. The thing that I think about with what you're trying to teach this weekend and kind of what also is taught in the other courses with the Institute of Physical Art are the three pillars being mechanical capacity, neuromuscular capability, motor control, and how well that kind of pieces together, you know, those particular components for anybody that comes in our door. And I'm not as well versed as you are in other things in terms of what the things that you've learned over the years. But is there any particular organization that speaks to, you know, those particular things as well as that, you know, what the IPA says? Because I've heard other people say similar stuff, but they don't articulate it quite as well, or they don't really emphasize it as much as, you know, they might think they do. And I'm kind of curious if you've run across that, or because I see tremendous value in that. And to me, it's kind of a lens that I basically look at anything. And one of the nice things that I think with the kind of stuff that you're teaching this weekend or the other things that that we do get to teach is you can incorporate anything into it. And like I've heard Earl Pettman say, you know, crediting David Lamb, steal from the best and get rid of the rest. And so I almost feel like, you know, we can really incorporate anything into what we do because, you know, I'm keeping those three things in mind. You know, is it mechanical, is it neuromuscular, is it motor control? And like I was mentioning earlier, sometimes it's not nearly as much of a mechanical issue as I once thought. And it's really more of a neuromuscular problem or even, you know, further than that, motor control. So have you run into that in any other circles or, you know, your own thoughts regarding that?
Well, Matt, what I'll tell you is I think that the Institute of Physical Art incorporates all the components well, because Greg Johnson's basis was PNF. And then when he branched out and started learning more and more manipulative techniques, soft tissue techniques, he did Astern patterning, he trained with a lot of wonderful people because PNF was his basis, and because he started with neurologically involved patients, he was able to really incorporate their motor control and neuromuscular reeducation component into the manual therapy paradigm. I think that there's a lot of very, very good physical therapists. Speaking of Earl Pettman, who's, again, one of my favorite people, I've done a lot of coursework with him. Back in the early 2000s, I was taking in level 3 upper quadrant with him. And I watched him do a demo on one of the participants. He did a wonderful manual therapy technique. And afterward, I watched him do PNF cervical patterns. And I said, Earl, why are you doing that? He said, well, Mike, I need to do neuromuscular education and motor control to reemphasize control in the new range. And I said, oh, that's great. Kind of sounds like the IPA. And I think everybody kind of intermingles. I haven't taken any classes from him, but I've always wanted to, is Michael Moore up at the Folsom Group, who's absolutely phenomenal. And he was a big PNF person. He was in Vallejo in the early 1970s. I know that Bill O'Grady, who was a phenomenal physical therapist, he was in Vallejo in the 1970s. I think a lot of the people, the late Peter Edgelow, who passed away, who was a phenomenal manual therapist, he was in Vallejo. I think a lot of people who were trained in Vallejo in the 70s, you know, under Maggie Knott, in the 80s, in the 90s, even now, because they have that PNF background, they can incorporate that in all their other manual techniques. I think the IPA, though, really does a great job with that, just because Greg Johnson, he really was, I believe, a protege of Maggie Knott. And I really think he's blessed. I really think he just has some phenomenal manual therapy skills, and he's able to incorporate the PNF component with it, with his other soft tissue manipulation, visceral techniques, and kind of take it that step further. But I think there's a lot of wonderful organizations. I think they're all good. I think anything you could learn from is terrific. I think if you have a PNF background or you take some PNF classes, I think you could incorporate that into any manual therapy technique you learn. And so you may not be in an organization that stresses that component, but if you get a decent background in PNF, you can do that yourself. Just start incorporating it, see what happens. As long as you don't hurt anybody, that's the big thing. The worst thing that can happen is it doesn't make a significant change. If somebody's having any discomfort, stop what you're doing. Change it, do something else. Remember, we work for the patient. My job is not to make the patient better at PNF. It's to use PNF philosophy and treatment and patterns to get the patient better functionally, and that's really what I'm looking for. And so if you're in an organization that you're working with a specific technique, incorporate PNF in addition to that. Okay.
Yeah, it's great. So I honestly got kind of wrapped up in you know what you were just saying, and I didn't really think of the next follow up question related to that. But it's impressive to see somebody that has such an eclectic background of all these different things and can relate those things very easily within a course setting or just a one-on-one setting. I'm only imagining what it would be like in the clinic, you know, getting to work with you, but, all the different stuff that we've learned this weekend, I can imagine is incredibly useful for any particular person that walks through the door. You've given plenty of examples of whether it's neurologically impaired patients or not, how you can use different aspects of a pattern or different end of a diagonal or being from one upper extremity to the opposite lower extremity to get
or just a
resist a gait, you know, all these different things that we can use to help regain people's function better. And honestly, it when you do it right, it takes significantly less time than I would have ever imagined. Because in the class, whether you're practicing things on the US participants or the actual patients that come in, you're not sitting there doing patterns on them for 20 minutes. It's like a handful of reps, and then you're moving on to the next thing. Can you talk about that for just a moment? Because I'm honestly a little surprised at how little it actually takes to improve some of these things compared to what I would have imagined, you know, not knowing any better, and how when you're doing things correctly, it really doesn't take as much time as, you know, some people might not imagine, or some people may imagine, and, you know, me being one of those.
Well, sure. Well, you know, the big thing is, if you're going to change somebody's movement pattern, you need to do a lot of resistance, let me step back on that. You need to use appropriate resistance with appropriate amount of repetition to make changes, especially somebody's habit. The but is, I may only do a few patterns or techniques on one area to bring them up to the point where they really need to work more functionally and give them a higher repetition home program. So an example is, I may want to get them doing something in standing, or I may want to get them doing something in rolling, but they're having difficulty working with the shoulder girdle, with the pelvic girdle. They're having a problem keeping their lumbar spine stable when they're flexing their hip, when they're doing a lower extremity flexion pattern. They're having a hard time with bridging. They're having a hard time with supine to sit. They're having a hard time with rolling. It hurts their back. And so I may only have to do a few patterns to facilitate increased motor unit contraction or increased motor unit facilitation to make them more stable, make them more efficient. Once they're there, I'll get them to a higher level. Once they're there, I'll get them to another higher level. So when I get them to the level they need to be functionally, I'll get one or two or even three exercises that they'll do at home for a significantly greater number of repetitions to actually get stronger, to increase cross-sectional strength of that, or cross-sectional fiber diameter at sarcomere. That takes a while, right? To increase muscle fiber strength, what? 3 to 6 weeks, 4 to 8 weeks? If you're young, strong, and healthy, right? Yeah. But to increase functional strength, I could do that in 2 minutes. I'm increasing motor unit recruitment of some you already have. So it doesn't take long to do that, but to change somebody's motor patterns, you have to figure out what's going to give you the biggest bang for the buck. I may do different patterns to get them there, and then when I find that one key movement, then that's what they're going to do with quite a few repetitions or a prolonged hold at home, depending on what they need.
So I've mentioned it, and you mentioned it, and you discussed a lot about patterns as they relate to PNF. Is there ever a time in the clinic that you're doing PNF out of pattern, you know, any pattern, where you're using PNF principles or concepts not in any pattern at all? And B, if so, why?
So that's a great question. So the answer is yeah. You can widen out the diagonal patterns. PNF is a philosophy in treatment. The patterns were developed last. Dr. Cabot developed the basic principles first of appropriate patient position, therapist position, manual contacts, appropriate traction and or approximation blended with appropriate resistance, that amount that allows a smooth coordinated movement to occur, utilization of the quick stretch reflex, utilization of approximation, utilization of the diagonal pattern was really last, verbal and visual cues, but the diagonal was last. Those are the last things he developed. So 100% you can work the person out of the pattern and still get great changes. The first time I really saw somebody who was wonderful at PNF work outside the pattern was when I was at Kaiser Vallejo and I was watching Sue Adler, who again is a phenomenal physical therapist, and she started moving the person out of the pattern. I go, Sue, why are you doing that? She goes, because that's functionally what the patient needs to do. That's what they need to do. Now, when I was there, we were having a lot of quadriplegic patients developing shoulder pain. This was back in the early 90s. And myself and Sharon Nicholas came, and also Christina Stock-Bertolet and Russell Lee, we came up with this PNF quad shoulder protocol, PNF quadriplegic shoulder protocol of 7 exercises to help. And we started really looking at why our patients were developing shoulder pain. It was really with weight bearing and transitional movements because they weren't centering humeral head. Now we're talking spinal cord. Well, we developed these exercises and had phenomenal results with it. When Dr. Cabot was there, I was extremely apprehensive. I said, Dr. Cabot, I would really like to show you what we came up with. We're working with the principles and techniques, but then we're actually coming out of the patterns. And he looked at it and he watched me do it. And he said, Mike, I never expected PNF to be stuck in 1950, and I'm glad this works. And I felt much more comfortable. Now, the other part of that is I may be working an upper extremity or lower extremity component out of pattern, but I may be using the contralateral extremity in pattern to irradiate or get purposeful spreading of response into the more dysfunctional component because it's more efficient to do that. So the person may be an athlete, they may be a construction worker, they may have to get in an awkward position because they're a building inspector, they're underneath a house, they may have had a stroke, they may have had incomplete spinal cord injury, they may have Guillain-Barré, they may have MS, and functionally they're telling me this is the activity they need to do. And so I ask them to show me how to do it, and then I may use PNF patterns at another extremity to facilitate increased neuromuscular education, motor control strength in that dysfunctional component, and I get better irradiation in pattern. But I may be doing a technique with another extremity out of pattern. Does that make sense? So yeah. We use the patterns to irradiate indirectly, but you can always work outside of patterns. You need to use PNF to help improve a person's function. Again, I say it over and over again. My goal is not to get the patient better at PNF. It's to use the PNF philosophy and treatment to help improve the person, the patient's functional ability, decrease their pain, increase their motor control, allow them to do what they want to do in a more pain-free and a more efficient manner.
So I think that's perfect to hear. I want to hear a little bit, if you don't mind. I think you mentioned in our first conversation about her, but was Sue Adler one of your main mentors when you were in Vallejo?
Absolutely.
Can you talk about Sue Adler in general?
Right.
I know her as the co-author of PNF in practice. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've heard Greg say some wonderful things about her, but since you got to spend a lot of time with her, can you talk about her? Because I know you said she's very petite but powerful, and she's one of the most skillful people with PNF that you've ever seen.
Yeah, 100%. You know, aside from Greg Johnson, she's probably the most skillful person with PNF I've ever seen. Sue's out in Chicago now. She's in her mid-80s. Last time I saw her was a couple of years ago. I actually went out to another physical therapist clinic, Greg Paparocki, because Greg had told me she was out there, and I hadn't seen her in years, and I wanted to see her, and we got to spend a little bit of time together. Sue trained directly under Maggie Knott in the late 1960s, and she was there in the 1970s. And when I was there at the Kaiser Vallejo program, she would come once a week, and she would mentor for some of the advanced training. And I really, really got to see her treat patients. And when Dr. Cabot was there, she spent a lot of time with Dr. Cabot and helped us really try to understand some of the things that he was doing. I got a chance to work with Sue, helping her out, as did other people from Kaiser Vallejo, when she was teaching at University of California, San Francisco, for their PT program for the PNF section. And again, I watched her do some phenomenal patient demos and was totally blown away. And she's absolutely terrific lady. Also very eclectic, very, very skillful, and she will really let you know when things work and when they don't work. And she'll do it in such a way where you'll say, wow, that you're correct. Thank you for showing me that, because she's very straightforward and direct. And she'll say, okay, try it a different way. And she'll give you one or two suggestions that make all the difference in the world. Change your body position, change your angles, change your approximation, mirror the person, stay with them, don't bounce off them with a quick stretch. Little things, don't over-rotate, that really made the biggest difference night and day with my skill level as far as PNF, as did Greg Johnson. And just really a pleasure. It was really a pleasure to know, and I absolutely consider her, and I think everybody else at Kaiser Vallejo who had trained underneath her considers her a mentor. She is really instrumental in starting the International PNF Association. When I was in Kaiser Vallejo, we had physical therapists coming from all over the world to get trained, and the majority of them came to not only get trained in PNF, but also get mentored by Sue. So it was just a blessing to be there when she was teaching. It was absolutely fantastic.
So can you also talk about the time you got to spend with Dr. Cabot whenever he came back? Like the either different things that you got to learn from him that you weren't taught before, or just kind of what that was like, you know, because that was, I don't know, 30 years after he left Vallejo. I don't remember when he left, but
I don't know, 1950 he came back.
Yeah.
'93.
Yeah. So super long time after he left Vallejo, but can you talk a little bit about the time you got to spend with him?
Sure. Absolutely. So Dr. Cabot was one of the kindest individuals I'd ever met in my life. He was a very humble guy. He had been in Providence, Rhode Island for probably 40 years. And we had the first ever International PNF Association Conference of Vallejo, California. Our director at the time, Mary Louise Hink Mangold, who very sadly passed away a few years ago, had found that Dr. Cabot was still alive. She went to Providence, Rhode Island. She brought him and his wife out to Vallejo. He was keynote speaker, and he stayed for about 6 months, and I got to work with him. I left in 94. He came back another year, and shortly after that passed. And some of the things he showed us, one that was just incredible, and he demoed it on one of the participants at the first class, at the IPNFA class, was a physical therapist who had MS, and she was having some difficulty going downstairs, and she had multibuclonus. And he did a technique called sustained lengthening, where he had the person go into full plantar flexion. First, he resisted it. Then he'd have them go into unilateral plantar flexion, unilateral standing on their ball of their feet, and just stay there till it fatigued out without reinitiation. And it was significant. He changed multi-beat clonus to 1 to 2-beat clonus. And I've done that on a lot of my higher-level neurologically involved patients, higher-level stroke, higher-level incomplete spinal cord. And I've had absolutely dramatic changes with that. He came up with a technique to facilitate short neck flexion. It was a self-traction technique with axial elongation. Greg Johnson and Peter Edgelow. Peter Edgelow has had that technique published in his chapter on thoracic outlet syndrome, a new approach in the Donatelli book. I want to tell you it was either the third or fourth edition. Greg Johnson has taken his work and increased it to the umpteenth level. But what he was looking at is looking at axial elongation, facilitating short neck flexion, to increase core stabilization of the lumbar spine, as well as cervical dysfunction. And we saw tremendous results with that. In fact, I used that today on one of our patients who had the brainstem, vertebral basal artery dissection with brainstem infarct. And it made significant difference with him even transitioning from supine to sit. He made huge changes and my back doesn't hurt. And it was just really a pleasure. You know, I saw Dr. Cabot do facilitation techniques to increase arousal through people by, you know, bouncing them on a ball and getting in their limbic system. I saw him do patterns on patients. And you have to remember, when I was with him, he was 82 years old, and he was treating patients with the same amount of energy and vigor as I was, and that I was in my late 20s, and he was absolutely incredible. And again, very humble guy, and very free with sharing information, and just very kind in his positive reinforcement and constructive criticism. So he was a great guy, and his wife was wonderful, and just a pleasure to be around.
So whenever you first got to Vallejo and you're learning all these different things about PNF, the philosophy, the different patterns, you know, everything, what, because you were talking about Sue Adler and she used to yell at you.
Well, she gave me constructive criticism in a very passionate way.
Very, very nicely worded.
Oh, very nicely.
One of the things I was going to ask you, though, is for you personally, because, I mean, this isn't easy to learn. Right, this takes a lot of dedication. Takes time and dedication. What were some of the things that you yourself, I wouldn't say struggled with, but that you in particularly, you know, needed help with while you were there? Or to spin it another way, because you were also an instructor there for many years, what were common things that you would see in the students or the therapists that came there to learn that, you know, almost that so many people needed work on that you would see often enough.
Sure. So, you know, when I was there, we talk about Sue Adler, but, you know, we really have to talk about a lot of the other instructors there, too. You really have to give shout-outs to Hink Mangold, who unfortunately passed away, Chris Pappas, Tim Jostin, Dutch Hoffmeister was there, Pat Reagan was terrific. There was a lot of very good people. Peggy Loney was there. Ann Zerner was there. Just really, really a great bunch of people, as there is now. Terry Harrell's over there, great bunch of people. Mary Jew's over there. Just everybody was very good. And, you know, one of the biggest things is using appropriate body mechanics, not over-resisting, and really looking at what is the patient doing well. Because, again, it's very easy to say, okay, this is what they're not doing. This is what they're having dysfunction with. This is where they're having increased spasticity. They're not having active isolated movement. They're pulling into pathological synergies. They have significant difficulty with transfers. They have significant difficulty with standing balance or sitting balance. That's easy to pick up. What's maybe more important is what are they doing well? And then how can you use what they're doing well to enhance and facilitate what they're not doing well, enhance their function? And, you know, really looking at, okay, where are these patterns and what's the interrelationship between one pattern to the next? What's the interrelationship with the opposite end of the diagonal causing most of the time the greatest amount of irradiation, purposeful spreading of response? How can you not increase their tone? How do you utilize quick stretch? Quick stretch was huge. Everybody bounced off a quick stretch. You know, quick stretch is utilizing the quick stretch reflex to facilitate and enhance speed of initiation of movement, strength, speed, and power of movement. So you can do it at the beginning of the movement or through an already contracting muscle group. And, you know, one of the problems was a timing issue. You don't want to bounce off that quick stretch. If you don't resist quick stretch, it becomes inhibitory versus facilitatory. So, you know, timing. Resisted gait was a big one. Again, getting the lumbar spine, lumbopelvic areas are more in a neutral position, getting core contraction, stabilizing reversals, and then weight shifting, and then having something to stretch off of. And again, with quick stretch, don't bounce. So we saw that pretty frequently. So some of the biggest problems were people were able to get the patterns, but then incorporating some more of the basic principles, especially what is appropriate resistance? How do you incorporate the traction component, the approximation component? How do you switch from traction through the pattern to approximation at end range? How do you keep the pattern in its diagonal and not vary from it? How do you combine the pattern with other techniques to facilitate smooth coordinated movement if there's a mechanical dysfunction? You know, you may have a joint dysfunction or soft tissue restriction. You may have to address that in addition to the PNF neuromuscular education component. So that was a big deal. Really being patient with yourself and understanding you're not going to learn these things overnight. You know, I really enjoyed my time at Kaiser Vallejo, and I really stayed because I wanted to learn more and more. And, I did instruct there, and there's wonderful people there, and I learned every day. Every day somebody taught me something new, whether it was a patient, a course participant, or a fellow instructor. Everybody had something to share, and just when you think you have it perfected, somebody comes in and shows you a different way to do it, and you get humbled again. So it was terrific. And, you know, just knowing that you can figure out ways that fit your own body style. Here's a pattern. Figure out a grip that fits what your restrictions can be. If you as a therapist may have a cervical dysfunction, lumbar dysfunction, shoulder dysfunction. So the grip, the technique you're taught may be difficult for you. Is there another way that you could modify where your handholds are to make the pattern more efficient? And there are, and that's what you find out. So, you know, there's a lot to it, and you have to really want to learn it. And the people who go to the Vallejo program, the people who go to the IPA classes, people who go to all classes, I really think have a sincere desire to learn, because otherwise, why would you take the time and effort to go to the class? So my expectation is that everybody who goes to any Con Ed class is motivated to learn, and you just need to put yourself in a place where you put your ego in your back pocket, and you're willing to accept new information, because it's very easy to go back to what you're good at. And sometimes you fall into a rut. And so to learn new information, you have to be open to there's other ways to still get very positive results. And, you know, I think the most humbling thing was to work with people much better than myself. And once I thought I had a technique, to have somebody show me there's another way to do it and accept that. And you go, wow, there's a lot of different ways to do this. So, you know, again, these are different skill sets and everybody has something to teach everybody else. And really the goal is, how do you improve patient care? And if you go in with that mindset, it works very well.
Yeah, I think you said it day one of the course. And I've heard other people say it too, but it's, you know, I've never come in, or I've never had a patient walk in with a shoulder problem. I've never had a shoulder problem walk in the door. I treat patients, you know, I treat
human beings.
Yeah. That kind of, you know, always sticks with me whenever I hear somebody say something like that, because as much skill and time and effort it takes to learn anything and perfect anything, you can get wrapped up in that and forget the ultimate goal is to help the human being that's in front of you. And that may not always be performing some fantastic PNF technique or, you know, some high level skill manual therapy technique. It could be something very simple that, you know, doesn't require any of those things to help the human being that's in front of you. So, you know, thinking this is a pretty good place to stop, but do you have anything else that you want to mention, you know, related to anything we've talked about or not talked about at this point?
Well, absolutely. I want to thank you, Matt, because again, it's been a pleasure, and I've watched you just grow so much in the last few years, and you've really become an exemplary physical therapist. And, you know, just to be open-minded and take as many classes as you feel comfortable doing. And that's for everybody who's listening. And, you know, everybody always has something to teach you. Sometimes though, the most important thing is to know when something's outside your scope of practice and know when to refer them to someone else who has a different skill set. And that may not be in physical therapy. You may need to refer them back to the physician. And that's a big deal. You know, a big deal is knowing, as my friend Kent Kaiser would say, when it looks like a horse, smells like a horse, sounds like a horse, it might be a zebra. And when features don't fit, there may be something more sinister occurring. And, you know, that rib issue you're looking at may be a primary Ewing sarcoma. That hip problem that you think is OA may be a primary tumor. That fatigability may be a cardiac issue. That weakness in the leg may not be disuse atrophy, it may be spinal cord compression. And so you really need to look at, you know, basic scanning exams, basic evaluation techniques, check, is there a multibeclonus? Is there a positive Babinski? Is there a positive Hoffman's test? Somebody comes in and go, hey, I got a calf strain. Yeah, you better make sure they don't have a DVT. And if you suspect they do, you better send them in to get checked, because, you know, unfortunately, those type of things sometimes get missed and those become life-threatening. So, you know, I think it's important to improve your skill as a physical therapist, improve your skill as far as your evaluative techniques, but also know when features don't fit, when to refer them on to someone who has a different skill set or back to physician. And I think it's really important that you need to be a patient advocate, because sometimes you may be the only person who really believes the patient has a problem. And when it's all said and done, you may be the one person who got that patient to the right healthcare practitioner and maybe saved that person's life. Okay. And we've seen that where, unfortunately, some of the things we've seen that were diagnosed musculoskeletal did turn into they turned out to be cancer, or they turned out to be a tethered cord, or they turned out to be a kidney infection versus a back problem. So sometimes it's important to get them back to that practitioner to make sure they don't go into urosepsis or they don't get labeled as a conversion reaction. So those are important things.
Thanks. Well, thanks for spending the time with me tonight. You know, certainly appreciate it, and I know others will too. Hope it's not so long before we see each other again.
Oh, I hope we see each other sooner than later.
All right. Well, thanks again. Certainly appreciate it. Here you go.
Yeah, need to give a shout out to my wife and kids. Okay, love you, Victoria and Simon and Sophia, and happy birthday to Bruce. That's our pharmacist's son who's over at OHSU.
Nice. Well, I don't know if they'll listen to this, but hey, if they do, that's great. So thanks again, everybody, for listening. We'll try and get in touch with you again soon. Oh, one more thing.
Oh, and shout out to the grandkids. Can't forget the grandkids and the daughter-in-law. So shout out to Griffin and Aaliyah.
All right. With that, everybody, enjoy. We'll talk to you next time. Well, there you have it, my last conversation with Mike Baum in this podcast. Hope you all enjoyed it. As always, I certainly did. It's always fun to get to talk with the guests that we have here, and honestly, I appreciate everyone following and listening. I know I haven't been able to really get out a lot of content recently, so appreciate everybody still staying up on everything that comes out. Hopefully we'll have some more podcasts and videos and other posts coming out in the near future. But for now, thanks a lot. As I said before, please check us out on different social media accounts. There's Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, whatever you like the most. Also, there's our YouTube channel that you can look at. These podcasts are on Apple Podcast, Spotify, as well as Stitcher. Maybe someday I'll get around to Google Play, but I haven't really put much effort into that. So check it out on those other podcast platforms and subscribe. Make sure that you're always getting these as they come out. Or subscribe to the website. That way you'll get an email whenever these new posts come up. Yeah, so other than that, please share with a friend. Always enjoy your feedback. Leave us a comment on any of those social media accounts or the YouTube videos. Send me a personal email if you like. You can always do that through the Contact Us page on the website. But otherwise, thank you all. I certainly appreciate all you listeners out there. If you have anything that you'd like to have me do, or persons that you'd like to have me talk to or anything, by all means, please let me know. Other than that, have a wonderful day and enjoy your weekend.